You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Hey, it's Chris Spangle, the host of We Are Libertarians, and I'm here to tell you about our advertiser for this month, and it is the Jason Stapleton Program. Jason is a good friend of our show and has been the only guy that we've let buy advertising on our program. You know that we're not really big on paid advertisements, but we believe in what Jason does on a daily basis. He does what we do. He examines current events from a libertarian perspective, and he does it 5 days a week. Go check out Jason's podcast at iTunes. Check out his YouTube channel. It is amazing. His video setup is just so beautiful and professional. Jason is just professional. You know, he's everything that we're not. So visit jasonstapleton.com. You won't be disappointed. It's a highly engaging program, and he's a great guy. And we at We Are Libertarians love Jason, and we want you to love him too. So please go to jasonstapleton.com and check out his program. Download his podcast, check out his YouTube, and visit jasonstapleton.com.
We are supported by listeners like you. Donate per month or make a one-time donation through PayPal or Patreon at wearelibertarians.com.
It's Chris Spangle, host of We Are Libertarians, and I want to tell you about our friends at Lions of Liberty. It is a podcast very much like ours. It is a group of guys who are motivated to entertain you and inform you at the same time. They have a show that is released 3 times per week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Friday is Felony Friday. It's a special show about the broken criminal justice system. You can find Lions of Liberty on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and on lionsofliberty.com. Seriously, these guys are great. If you love our show, you're going to love Lions of Liberty. Very similar to what we do. They have conversation about current events. They interview people that are very interesting. While their show is very similar to like ours, they have a lot of different opinions than we do. So I think if you love We Are Libertarians, then you are going to love Lions of Liberty. So get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at lionsofliberty.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I am your host, Chris Spangle. We Are Libertarians brings you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. We explain to you what the hell is happening in our world today and how we can fix it by thinking differently. Even differently than most libertarians sometimes. This is a podcast brought to you by We Are Libertarians Network. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, share this episode with friends, and support us through PayPal or Patreon at wearelibertarians.com. And we're always taking your questions or comments at editor@wearelibertarians. To my left today is the affable Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you?
Well, I got to tell you, usually I am quite affable.
You are.
Usually I'm in a rather good mood.
You seem agitated today. Is something wrong?
There's a little something that's, I don't tend to get upset.
I know. I don't think I've ever seen you upset.
You triggered me. You triggered me today. And that's pretty rare.
How did I trigger you?
Well, I'll tell you. Earlier this spring, you may remember that you had talked about a fictional run for national chair.
Well, it wasn't national. It was just chair.
Just general chair of all libertarians.
I was running for chair. I didn't. The Indiana State LP chair got very nervous and said, "Oh, well, good luck taking me on." I said, I didn't say Indiana State chair.
Please, not you little people.
No. I said chair.
Chair. Okay. So your fictional general chair.
Right. I had three platforms.
What were they?
They were no platform, mm-hmm. No bylaws, mm-hmm. Because the discussion, I'm against wasting time. I'm a very efficient man, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't like things that
the
waste
most
our
efficient.
Time. Shh. God doesn't understand comedy, does he? I'm very efficient. Of all the ways that I use my time, I use all the efficient ways. And so I think things that are a waste of time are platforms, bylaws, and Bittner.
Right.
So I'm against platforms, I'm against bylaws, and I'm against Bittner.
Could I assume that was a campaign promise?
Yeah, you could say that.
So that was a pledge, if you will. You signed the pledge.
I signed a pledge. Never Bittner.
So imagine...
I started a hashtag.
Imagine how I felt on this beautiful night. It's about... Late 70s, or high 70s, zero humidity, nice breeze. We don't get many days like this in Indiana.
No,
getting ready to record. I come in. I pick up Brozini's pizza.
Yeah, thank you. I hadn't eaten yet.
It was delicious. Thank you.
And I walk in.
Uh-huh.
How do you think I felt? Why do you...
Betrayed. Bewildered.
Why would I feel betrayed? What was there?
There was Bittner.
Right. There was Bittner. There was Bittner.
And I have to say, it's been the most annoying setting up of a podcast we've ever had, hasn't it?
I gotta say, I took you at your word. I've always trusted you.
Right.
I've always believed that you're a man who does what he says and says what he means.
Mm-hmm.
And you said never Bittner, and you ruined my night. I brought you pizza, I brought you friendship, and I brought you a podcast co-host, and you reneged, and there's
whoa,
Bittner.
Whoa, triggered.
Sorry, Harry.
No, I didn't, because I didn't invite Brett Bittner here.
Uh-huh.
You know who invited Brett Bittner here?
Who invited Brett Bittner here?
Brett Bittner.
Did Brett Bittner.
He sure did.
Did Bittner.
Joining us is Brett Bittner.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Son of a
Hey, bit. Greg. I've got something for you. If you go to tchip.com/neverbittner2, you, too, can have a Never Bittner t-shirt.
Why would I want a Never Bittner t-shirt when I just want Never Bittner?
It's the best way to get rid of me is to buy the t-shirt.
I feel like I'm owed an apology. I'll be honest. I feel like there's an apology owed. I feel like there's not only an apology owed to me. I feel like there's an apology owed to our listeners, to our sponsors, to Nick Sarwak even, to the National Party, Gary Johnson, and Libertarian Jesus himself, Ron Paul.
Well, here's why an apology is not in order. We are on the board for America's Future Foundation of Indianapolis. We put together many great events. All the best events in Indianapolis are held by AFF Indy. And you can find the link to that at WeAreLibertarians.com if you're in the Indianapolis area. We recently had a board meeting, and you and I were talking, and I said, hey, when do you want to record this week? And little Brett Bittner, speaking up at his own pace, goes, I really need to come on because I've got something I need to talk about. You remember that thing that you spent a year working on in 2013 that I demolished and then rebuilt in the likeness of Brett Bittner?
Well, some might say late term aborted.
Late term abittered.
He goes, abortion, if you will.
He goes, I need to come on your podcast, and I need to talk about the thing that you used to have that I destroyed and rebuilt in my own image.
Well, you remember that thing you did? Yeah, got rid of that. However, totally there's a new version. It's way better.
Way
People
better.
Love it. They tell me it's the greatest. I have the greatest new versions of things you once did poorly.
Yes, that's actually true.
I looked over at little Dustin Sharpless. His mouth was agape. He couldn't believe that he had just seen a true Bittner. And he'd seen a Bittner moment in, like Chloe didn't even flinch.
A true Bittnerian moment, if you will.
So he comes on, he invites himself on this program, and we say, well, we can't do this week because this week's going to be pretty political. We're going to talk about this. That's when we had Dustin on and we argued about that.
We tried to schedule around No Show and Agnos about 35 times.
Right.
She literally must have the social calendar of Paris Hilton.
So I go, next Thursday. Let's do it next Thursday. Brett goes, I could, but my assistant Chloe says that she can't. And so No Show and Agnos goes, yeah, I can't, but I'm wide open the next week. I said, all right, lock it in. Thursday of the week after, which is tonight. So what, Tuesday, Wednesday this week, I go, hey, you guys still on for Thursday?
Oh, I can't. I've got to go wear no deodorant somewhere and smell their bathroom up like I did yours.
No Show and Agnos doesn't show up. Doesn't even say it herself.
To be fair, the odor is much more pleasant.
Sure. I'll say this. What he lacks in personality, Bittner makes up in smelling well.
He has been called kempt.
Yes, he's an he's been called an unkempt political dad.
Unkempt.
She did take that back.
Okay, you're kempt.
I'm kempt.
Yeah, I'm very kempt.
Very kempt.
So, Anagnos, no shows again, and so 35 different times, and Brett, of course, over here is being a true Bittner, and he's going, I'm not coming if I can't have Chloe here. And I was so close. Greg knows me better than anybody.
Yeah.
I was so close to going, well, then it's never going to happen because I'm never having Chloe back on again.
Ever.
And I was about ready to tell you and Anagnos to shove it right up your world's smallest political quiz.
Yeah.
But I love the Advocate so much. So much that I will even have Brett Bittner on this program.
But that wasn't an apology.
I'm Wait, not are, going are to apologize. About, I did let nothing me, let wrong.
Let Director me just, of Special Programs, Brett Bittner?
You're special, all right.
All right.
programming at your own pace.
The short bus programming initiative. No, but let me give you perspective. Had I done this to you, I want you to put the shoe on the other foot. So let's imagine it's tonight. You had just gone to Kroger and you had gone and gotten your favorite tofu bacon flavored, you know, vegan fillets.
A nice low calorie sushi.
Something, and you put them on your electric grill. It's a nice night out. You come inside for a wonderful little family dinner with Mittens and Cornelius.
A cheap shot. Alone. Just say it. Alone.
There were two cats here. I'm saying that solitude is wonderful. Have you met other people?
Oh, I've been solituding the shit out of myself lately.
So you're enjoying your tofu. And I knock on your door, and you come up. You haven't even got to dig into your vegan fillets. And I open the door and say, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I got a surprise for you. And it's Ebola. Or it's the Holocaust. How would you feel?
Well, I would feel less hurt than you do right now.
That's exactly right.
Right.
And so I just want you to keep that in mind while you don't apologize.
I'm not apologizing.
We've got social Ebola in this house right now.
I just want to point out that the Never Bittner t-shirts, which I'm sure...
I'm not, he's freedoming.
I know. I'm not even going to get into the glasses because this is another stupid joke. Bittner jokes annoy me more than anything else. It's not even Bittner jokes. It's Bittner's joke is funny the first time. It's when Chloe repeats them 150 times that oh, is this a Benihana? Shut up! I can't take it anymore.
I'm going to chop you up like if...
Right. I'm going to put you in the top of my hat and call you an egg roll. So
you're gonna bake that Nazi cake, or I'm gonna make you wish this were the fucking Holocaust.
I vetoed 750 bills. I will veto your life. So Bittner has these glasses with the American flag on them, and he says he puts them on. He goes, time to go freedoming, and I want to punch him in the face every time he does it. But
awesome is this is actually Chloe's joke. When they arrived, and I put them on. She took the picture and shared it in our chat and was like, all right, guys, we're going freedoming. And it continues to this day.
But you see, it didn't need to continue. It's like saying I'm a Canadian. That joke wasn't funny 5 years. I go on my time.
What? I don't know that it's not funny.
Yeah.
No, it's funny how much I hate it.
That's what's really funny.
Yeah, that's the best part.
It's really not a funny joke. Your reaction's fantastically funny.
The best part of the Canadian joke is totally what Paul Copeland did by donating to Wall in Canadian.
It's right up there in the Wall.
It is awesome. That was the very best Canadian joke there was.
Paul, I will give credit to Paul Copeland. That was one of the funniest jokes ever, well ever to take place. Yes.
Connect Bucks.
So
nice bird.
I just don't want to engage you when you have those glasses on, so you can take those off or you can leave.
We're going freedoming, you guys.
I know.
We're gonna have to put a photo up.
Greg's ready.
He won't propose. He will not engage you.
I think
he's so triggered.
More than anyone else in my life, Greg Lins said it to me this week. He goes, listen, you attain true freedom in life when you don't feel the need to apologize. I don't.
I'm so proud of you, actually.
You've created a monster.
No, I'm actually very proud of you. I just hope you know that even if I showed up with the Holocaust and Ebola and surprised you on a night, I would still be less irritated, or you would still be less irritated than I am right now, because you said Never Bittner and you lied.
Bittner, if he showed up with the Holocaust, would we be surprised?
No, not in the slightest.
And frankly, neither would I.
The Ebola thing. Ebola. That one's a little...
I know. You can't go get that on every street corner.
No.
I don't know. maybe on the other side of the wall after you finish building it. No, I love the advocates. I love the advocates for self-government. I don't know that I'm thrilled with everything that Brett Bittner has done to her. He has shamed her in many ways. Most of all, he has changed libertarianism.com. Brett Bittner is the executive director of the Advocates for Self-Government, and he joins us on this program. And what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the basics of libertarianism and using libertarianism.com as our template. If you need to take the sunglasses off.
Brett, I'm waiting for Greg to take the picture.
Brett is wearing American flag sunglasses, and it is fully triggering me. I can't,
because we're going freedom.
I cannot handle it. And so Brett and Chloe of the Advocates, Chloe was supposed to be here, but no show in Agnos, couldn't make it. And so we're going to talk about the basics.
Rapturous stomach pains.
Yes. So we're going to talk a little bit about the basics of libertarianism. We have so many new listeners to the program, and a lot of people are interested in the basics of libertarianism. And there is no better place to learn about the basics of libertarianism than the Advocates for Self-Government and libertarianism.com, other than We Are Libertarians, where you can learn all the best things about libertarianism. So in this hour, we're going to talk a little bit about the basic principles of libertarianism. We're going to talk about our individual paths to libertarianism, and we're going to talk about the most important aspects of the philosophy to each of us. I think in an effort for the audience to get to know us a little bit better, I think we should start with our personal paths to libertarianism. I, of course, was a former Republican. Greg is a former Republican. And Brett Bittner, in true libertarian fashion, cannot conceive to quantify what he was.
He was basically the immaculately conceived libertarian.
Right.
He was totally untainted, born of a virgin, perfection. Libertarian perfection.
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah. Yeah.
So let's start with our very special guest, because you will not be returning, Brett Bittner. Let's talk a little bit about your path to libertarianism. When did you see the light? How did you come to see the Ron Paul Jesus? Were you walking down the road to Damascus and all of a sudden the light popped out? You know, Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell standing on the side and eating figs and wearing woolly hair.
No, not quite. It really, for me, I've never been a Republican. I've never been a Democrat. And so my first real interest in politics happened in 1992. When George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton were running against one another, and they had that guy with the big ears in the chart.
Can I finish?
Exactly. And I really found that he was talking about things in a different way than anybody else was at the time, and that was really appealing to me. He was talking about things. He was talking about economic issues that people weren't talking about. He was talking about the debt, which was something that people weren't talking about. And for me, that was very refreshing. And about 2 years later, on Atlanta Talk Radio on AM 750, Neil Bortz moved over from the smaller station, the smaller AM station, to the bigger AM station in Atlanta. And he really did share, he really encapsulated what I believed and introduced me to the label of libertarian.
Yeah, and Neil Bortz is the first place that I heard the word libertarian, and you are from Atlanta, Georgia, correct?
Yep, I am.
Right.
So I heard him talk about the ideas. I agreed with him probably 95% of the time. I thought, wow, this is really something that I need to look into, because I know that the D team and the R team aren't really speaking to me as an individual. They aren't garnering my interest,
right?
And they're not going to earn my vote. And at this time, I'm still a teenager. But I go through, and I have to say that Neil Bortz was a lot more libertarian early on.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
He became a little more scared of the brown people later on, especially after 9/11.
I don't know why you looked at me when you said that, Brett.
Well,
you're just as swarthy as I am, so judge not.
So, you know, for me, it was really an education as I would, you know, that was what was happening for me. I was listening to his show. I was learning about that there are people that are out there that are fiscally conservative and socially liberal. That was how libertarians were described at the time. I was somebody who had a very different view of a lot of things, and mm-hmm. Libertarian was just the label that did that.
Yeah,
and that was my path essentially. I you know, kind of a from a an economic populist in the Ross Perot era to finally finding a home when Neil Bortz described what a libertarian is. And that was really it. That was my path to libertarianism. When I went to college, I kind of checked out a little bit. And the early part of my post-college career, I wasn't very politically involved. And then I moved back to Atlanta in 2007.
Was it because you were just... you were dating a lot of women at that time? Is that...
that may or may not have had part of... something to do with it.
Being a libertarian, I'm going with the not having a part of it. What about you, Greg? Let me ask. I meant women, but little Brett Bittner, which is our affectionate name for Brett. If you know Brett and you see him, you must call him, by decree of dear leader myself, you must call him little Brett Bittner. What were some of the more helpful, other than a talk radio show that is no longer around, what are some of the more important books or resources or organizations that kind of helped shape your view of libertarianism? Where was the red meat that you grew those little muscles on?
Harry Brown. I read everything he ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I watched every interview that I could possibly watch in his efforts for the presidency in 96 and in 2000. I wanted to hear everything that he had to say.
Right.
One of my favorite libertarian books that's out there is actually Liberty A to Z.
Mm-hmm. That's a great book.
Which we actually sell. We publish at The Advocates. Theadvocates.org/store. You can find it there.
Right.
But Liberty A to Z is a collection of sound bites from Harry Brown where he really breaks down every possible political issue and shares with you in 10 seconds or less the libertarian view on it. And it's a very persuasive look at the issue to look at it through a libertarian lens. So I would say that Harry Brown. And then I probably followed that up with Libertarianism in One Lesson by David Berglund.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed about reading Harry Brown's books is I have one of them here. I forget the title of it, but it's kind of a red, white, and blue cover. It's just like his basic thoughts on, I think it might have been a campaign book. But it was reading through it, I thought, well, this will really apply. You know, I'm a new libertarian, and it must have been 2010 when I read this. And it's just so interesting to see how 10 years after the book was written, I think he wrote it in 96, so few of the things apply to our politics today in that particular book because we were talking about such different things back then. You know, so, yeah, any other media that really helped kind of shape that might, you know, people might access?
Well, you know, I think some of the things that happened in pop culture with The Matrix
mm-hmm.
Were certainly helpful.
Yeah, I agree.
And
yeah.
Just because it was showing what it's like to be somebody who's to be that the one that doesn't fit in to all of the people who are plugged in. You're very different. And,
right.
And so The Matrix kind of spoke to me in that way. Less so in the two sequels because I wasn't as active politically at the time.
Dating all those chicks.
Well, yeah.
Raw dog and randoms, if you will.
So... Greg Lenz of We Are Libertarians fame.
Libertarian podcaster Greg Lenz.
Yes. You know, it sounds so much better when Rob Kendall says veteran journalist.
Well, Rob Kendall is quite a man. Of all the men I know, Rob Kendall is one of the men that I know.
With a small board.
He's got a very small board. It's concerning how little his board is. He's got such a successful radio show, but such a small board. So I guess it's in how you
see
use
it. Todd Young on?
He did?
Yeah, Todd Young's a Marine, in case you guys didn't know.
So, Greg, how did you come to libertarianism?
You know, I've actually spent a couple of hours thinking about this last night, and it's really hard because I think I've always been, but then I didn't know obviously what that was like. And then I became a Bushite, you know,
right.
I became a great American.
Sure.
And
you loved America so hard. You wanted to destroy her.
I did. You know, in fact, freshman year of college, Rush Limbaugh's nephew, Chris, lived down the hall.
Ah, okay.
And this is when he's going through his drug problems.
Right.
And so I just sort of, you know, it was a school in Texas, private school, mainly white people. And so you were going to be a George W. Bush fan. It was just, if you like John Kerry, you were Bin Laden. And it was that simple. Like you wanted 9/11 to happen.
Right.
So it was inevitable. And so then, like, you know, you're idealistic, you're young, you join your team, join the team your parents were on. And then you abandon all rationality and reason. And all of a sudden you adopt the armaments of your squad. And it is, you know, everyone on the left is a liberal pinko egghead commie who hates America and needs to be destroyed rather than a rational individual with, you know, thoughts worthy of consideration. And, you know, you just end up, I got so down the rabbit hole of Muslims hate us for our freedom, all of them. Shia, Sunni, didn't know what I was talking about. Saddam Hussein committed 9/11. Shockingly, there are no Iraqis on those flights. You'd think, as a politically aware and active individual, I might have caught that detail. Totally missed it.
Not if you're reading conservative press. Not at that time.
And, you know, just would have never imagined that George W. Bush, in the proper framework of political philosophy, was actually too liberal.
Right.
You know, a conservative approach to foreign policy would be staying home, protecting your own borders.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be expanding Medicare Part D. It wouldn't be unpaid tax cuts. It just wouldn't be everything he did.
What about No Child Left Behind?
No Child Left Behind?
Oh, good. I mean, didn't want to forget that
pre-9/11. It wouldn't be bailing out the banks.
Bailing out the bank. I mean, he just literally, George W. Bush was a liberal.
Right.
I mean, he'd be the great, God, he'd be FDR to Democrats if he had just changed his party affiliation.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality is, I don't know. I got so lost in that. And then I sort of, it just like was like, oh my God, you know, maybe Muslims, maybe they don't completely hate us for our freedom. Maybe a little bit, but not all the way.
Right.
And like, I saw a Ron Paul protest in Newport or Laguna Beach in 2008 and started down the path of Ron Paul. But I knew I was a person. I didn't care what you did with your personal lifestyle. You do whatever you want. And I thought taxes were bad. And I thought spending was bad. But foreign policy really triggered me to realize just how important libertarian was. And that's what I believed. And, you know, how it's really the only shot at creating a peaceful situation and peace on earth, if you will. Kumbaya. And then joining the podcast, you know, because I was still more conservative.
January 2013.
Yeah.
Chris Spangle has launched a website. He has had a podcast for many years, and Chris Spangle decided, let there be a website. And on said website, one must have content. And so he looked upon the land of his friends, and he saw Little Greg Lens.
The Lens Review.
The Lens Review. A
10 to 15 links.
Every day. And I was like, bingo.
Yeah, which were already pretty libertarian.
Yeah. And I looked at it, I went, okay, that's libertarian enough. And
like, it wasn't until I joined the podcast, the pro-Hitler stuff really started.
It's weird how you went
that early on.
Right. It's weird how far down the dictatorial rabbit hole you've gone.
I gave up on democratic libertarianism. It's just never going to take hold.
You threw it right out of the helicopter.
Yeah, I did. But yeah.
So I had Greg on the first podcast. So I was like, oh, he's staying. Because I knew I was already firing Galt. I was like, so I got to have somebody else. We let go one of the permanent cast members. And so Greg moved in and has stayed ever since February-ish of, you know, 2013. Since the episode in the 30s.
Yeah.
And
gun control. I still remember gun control. Yeah. And I knew nothing really. Like, you know, I knew the conservative talking points and nothing else. And I just was so, you know, I don't even go back and listen now because I'm so embarrassed. But then I'll still remember my flipping point was when Creighton, who was a self-identified anarcho-capitalist, was making a conservative point. And I was like, no, that isn't right. And here's how you could actually do that, you know, with sort of a bond system for people who are rogue actors in an anarcho-capitalist society. And I'm like, oh my God, it just totally flipped. I've just went full Neo. I see the code now, you know, Matrix, obviously. And there was no stopping. I had to go all the way down the well. I had to start with Rothbard. I had to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I went down that rabbit hole. And then for me personally, like, I don't ever see a society getting past a minarchist state. And I think that's quite the task ahead right now. Especially if Gary Johnson isn't popular. Who knew?
Only amongst libertarians.
Yeah. Sorry, not to get off task. But and so I, being on the shows, you know, really filled out my philosophical education, and I am a voluntarist in theoretically, and then in practice I am a, you know, incremental, take what we can get, try to stem the tide of statism every chance you get, you know. And that's sort of what I believe and how I believe it. And then, you know, I throw in the occasional irrational support or rogue act in order to create an aura of unpredictability and freeze people.
Mostly me.
Sort of Nixon-esque.
Yeah, he really likes to make me think he's mentally ill sometimes.
Well, I love walls. I've always loved walls since I was a kid. I was a big Lego guy.
He just built walls.
I just built walls everywhere.
He built a wall around his sister one time, and she tried to get out, and he said, no, 10 feet higher.
Yes, physically removed, so to speak.
My story, so other than We Are Libertarians, I mean, what were some of the more foundational libertarian media outlets and books and resources that you found?
You know, they weren't, until I got to We Are Libertarians, there wasn't much interaction with libertarian principles. But, you know, like, so I came up as like a William F. Buckley conservative, so economic individualism and then, I guess, less libertinism and more, yeah. But, you know, William F. Buckley identified as a libertarian up until... really, Reagan got popular.
Right.
And so if you look at that, what the conservative movement was from the early 50s up until the 80s, it was primarily driven by sort of a, you know, back and forth between economic individualism only, no social issues or social policy, and then more of a communal approach.
Right.
Where it's a cautious, slow, you know, we're a social fabric. We need to make sure that the bonds don't break apart, otherwise radical change will come in. But I was always on the side of, it's an individual thing. As long as it doesn't hurt me, it's not my business.
Yeah.
Been that way my whole life. I grew up in the Methodist Church.
Yeah.
And homosexuality never bugged me, ever.
Being a convert to Christianity, there was a period of 5 years where I became pretty hardcore. But by and large, yeah, I mean, even in that period, I almost got kicked out of the College Republicans for thinking gay marriage wasn't a big deal in 2004. Who knew? Yeah, my path isn't a lot different than Greg's. I mean, we went to the same high school, went to the same church, both Republicans from a Republican county and a Republican community. You know, my grandparents and everybody were just kind of always. I was always a culturally Republican person, but it wasn't. I was always into politics, and I was always against Bill Clinton, but that's because my family was. And so, when I became more interested in politics, 9/11 really was life changing for me in so many different ways. It's what made me politically interested. And it's what made me spiritually interested. And it was just a very defining moment in my life. And I was 18, and I signed up for Selective Service. My birthday is September 9th, 2001. I turned 18. Signed up for Selective Service like a good American on September 10th, the day after my birthday. So I was eligible for the draft, and then 9/11 happened the next day, and I was,
there's a case that could be made.
Uh-oh.
Him joining the armed forces, his life of service.
Now, I was very pro-military, but I was very pro-military other people going. I was one of those Republicans. And I just was very, very jingoistic, you know, of course. Last name Spangle. Of course, I have to love my country, and I do. I held a pro-war rally on the day after Thanksgiving in 2003. It was a support the troops rally. Listened to a lot of conservative talk radio. I always had jobs where I listened to the radio all the time. You know, watering plants, delivering pizzas, construction cleanup. So I was just feeding my mind a steady diet of conservative talk radio for hours and hours and hours on end. Eventually got a job at a talk radio station with a guy named Abdul. So I heard the word libertarian from one of those talk show hosts, Neil Bortz, but it just didn't really register. I knew I agreed with him a lot of the time. And I knew that I wasn't totally a Republican because I was more libertarian in my beliefs in terms of people being able to do whatever they wanted. I just always thought, like, fighting the gay issue and trying to use religion, even though I was, you know, was a very hardcore Christian early on from 18 to 25, as many listeners point out, not as much lately. But at that point, I mean, it was, you know, I believed all the stuff that David Barton would say. I mean, it was, so I love talk radio and I always wanted to be a talk radio show host. So I've settled for this and, I wrote in when I was in college to the local talk radio station and complained about the Indians games, the local baseball games that were interrupting my Michael Savage time. And it was
you were a Savage listener.
Wow.
I pretty much agreed with him because like I read David Horowitz and I loved Frontline Mag and all that or whatever it is. Front page, Frontline. And he was just nuts. Like the reason I liked him was he once said, I'm like the crazy uncle that you can't wait to come over. They're there for more than 10 minutes and you can't wait for them to leave. And it was just such an apt description of him. So I was just very upset that it was interrupting my talk radio time. And I got to talking to the guy and he said, do you want to be an intern? So December of 2014 or 2004, I became an intern at a talk radio station and was on a morning show with a guy named Abdul Hakim Shabazz. A Muslim.
The worst one ever.
He's a terrible Muslim. He's like
the guy bathes in pork fat.
Right. And he loves to drink and cigars and yeah.
Haram, absolute haram.
But one of my best friends, and Abdul is a very intelligent man who is a lawyer, who has a lot of political experience and a very unique point of view. He would identify as a libertarian, although he is not libertarian in our classic sense. He loves politics. He loves politicians. He loves government. but he
not exactly our sense. No, he's a weldetarian.
But yeah, that's very true. But he's voting for Gary Johnson, and he's socially liberal, fiscally conservative. And I would spout off all these little Rush Limbaugh lines to him, and he would challenge each and every one, and he'd make me feel completely stupid. And like you, I go back and listen to those old episodes because I have a lot saved from 07-08 when I was actually the morning show producer. I go back and listen to those and I'm just so stupid. So dumb.
God, guns, guts, and America.
That's
all you need.
Knowing the basics of the Constitution, the basics of government, the basics of politics.
Well, there's no need.
Right. I knew I had I had Rush to explain it. Right. Yeah. And so he challenged, and he was really the person in 2004, 2005 that I was around that made me go, oh, man, I believe this stuff, but I'm not very smart about it. I don't know things. I better start researching. And so I started researching my
point
of view.
But I need more research.
Right. And I just started to realize, like, oh, I'm actually not right. So I was head of College Republicans around the same time. In 2004, I was head of the College Republicans at IUPUI. And this was the year of Bush and Bush getting reelected. And I proudly supported Bush. But I didn't think that his immigration plan was all that crazy. I actually thought it was pretty decent.
Pretty liberal.
Why can't there be? I mean, his plan looks a lot like what Gary Johnson's proposing now.
It's not a wall.
Right. It's not a wall. And the gay stuff is just like, who cares? Like, they're people too. Like, let's not demonize them. And I really, to this day, hate Karl Rove for making that the 2004 issue, because what Karl Rove did is he made it a political issue to win a campaign. And in the process, he destroyed the evangelical church. He made it so any time a pastor goes on a TV show, the first thing they're asked about is, do they hate homos? You know, and so that became the culture wars, and it created this sense in the Republican Party and conservative circles and the Christian community of victimhood, because the culture doesn't agree with them fully anymore. He destroyed the Republican Party with that issue. And that's the stuff that I was saying in 2004, going, who cares? We're at war. We have massive debt. We have, even though I was for Bush, I wasn't crazy about Bush. And ironically, I didn't help the Mitch Daniels campaign in his first run in 2004, despite him being a fairly libertarian politician, handing out to associates long past and currently what it means to be a libertarian by Charles Murray. And when you compare Pence and Mitch Daniels, a libertarian esque figure in politics, he wasn't libertarian. He wasn't. He just didn't. It just didn't jive. It's too much power. So I had to go help an underdog campaign, and it was the name by a guy by the name of Andy Horning in here in Indianapolis. Andy is a writer now on We Are Libertarians, a longtime friend. I've known him forever. And he, in the end of 2004, really kind of got me thinking. Abdul then just smashed all of those thoughts. Andy would come in and co-host, and I would, you know, being the backup board op, would talk with Andy extensively on those days. You know, on 4th of July, Andy would come in and host. And just... Andy and Abdul were the two most influential people to me. So I didn't have books necessarily. There were books that helped me along the way, like Healing Our World, which you can get at the Advocates website, which kind of gave me an emotional connection. But I didn't read that till 2013, you know, long until I was a libertarian. So eventually, you know, fast forward a few years, I get hired as the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana. I never really claimed the libertarian mantle until 2008, and it was because I was still a hawk. And it was Ron Paul and Chalmers Johnson and the blowback arguments that I really thought, you know what, that just makes too much sense. I can't argue with that. You know, I can argue with my points of view, but I can't argue with this. And... so I just officially became a libertarian, and I took a look at the Libertarian Party, and they were just missing so many political opportunities at that time. And you know, they still do. And they did when I was executive director. So I asked if they would hire me, and they hired me, and I worked there for 4 years, and I immersed myself for 4 years in libertarian culture and libertarian thought and libertarian political politics. Social networks. I spent 4 years waking up every day being Mr. Libertarian.
Yep.
You know,
I remember those days. For me,
yeah.
Too.
Brett did the same job in Georgia for 4 years. And, you know, it was really a formative time for me because people shaped my point of view by being so social with so many libertarians. But it also taught me a lot professionally. And allowed us to have, you know, damn near 20, 25 people that have come on this podcast over the course of the years and has built a great social network. So I'm more of a social libertarian than an intellectual libertarian. And I think, you know, that's why Greg always gets more intellectual credit than I do. You know, it's because he can read. But
well, you guys did go to public school.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Fighting Quakers, bruh.
So, you know, long story short, like if you're the type of person that like you're just not going to sit and read Rothbard, talk to people about Rothbard. I mean, that's kind of what I did. I mean, I'm an Austrian I believe in Austrian economics without ever having read a Mises textbook or having gone to Mises.com on a regular basis. But it's because I spend so much time talking to the people that do. That's a lot of what this podcast is. It's me just trying to go, hey, what's going on in the world? Explain it to me from a libertarian point
of view.
Osmosis,
really.
Yeah. To keep, you know, cause you can only read so much. And so we can share collective knowledge through this podcast and through local events. So that being said, let's talk about some of the pillars of libertarianism. Let's talk about what we think the most important aspects of libertarianism are. Like, if you had to nail down the bullet points, what would you say they are?
For me, it's the golden rule. You treat people like you want to be treated. I mean, it all comes down to that. You know that when you are in trouble and you need help, you want to know that there are going to be people that are going to help you because you've been treating people like that, and it's just kind of how it happens. You know, I don't initiate force. I don't want to hurt somebody. I don't want to take away somebody's life, liberty, or property. And, you know, you take a look at libertarianism, and really it all comes down to protecting those things. And the worst thing that you can do to somebody is take away their life. The second worst thing that you can do is take away, you can hurt them in a way that they can't fully enjoy their life. And so for me, it's all about making sure that I am living that life because I don't want to initiate force against somebody because I wouldn't want them to initiate force against me. Now, when it comes to self-defense or a response, it's very different because I'm kind of a burn it to the ground, you know, when you attack.
Being from Sherman territory.
Yeah. Hey, now. But, you know, you take a look at what makes people happy, and it is their life. It is the things that they can do. It is the things that they enjoy. And when you start to take away some of those things, you diminish their happiness. And obviously the ultimate diminishing of happiness is ending a life. Next is hurting. But if you take away somebody's liberty, you're boxing them in or you're preventing them from doing something. Usually that's through force or fraud. Sometimes it's physical intimidation, or you take somebody's property. And again, same thing. It's through force or fraud or through physical intimidation. And so to me, the most important thing, the absolute most important thing, is to live like I want people to live around me. I know I help people because I would want them to help me if I were in that situation. I've been there. I know what it's like to be really, really, really poor. Growing up, we were. Luckily, I'm not in that situation now. I mean, I remember the times where I didn't understand why we had to go to the library so that I could do my homework in the winter, and it's because it got dark at 6 o'clock and we didn't have any power. Mm. And we weren't going to have power for a couple of days. And that was, I just went to the library to do my homework, or I went over to a friend's house to do it because, but I didn't understand that that was what was happening. I was still young and, you know,
oblivious to,
I was just like, oh, well, everybody goes through this. Mm-hmm. And so I've been there and I know what that's like. And that's one of the reasons that I try to do what I can to help other people. And I know that I could do a whole lot more if I had more means to do so.
Sure.
And that's because part of my life, part of my liberty, part of my property is taken from me.
Have you ever considered joining a different political party? You joined the poverty party.
In many ways, I think that's the foundational principle. You know, when I first became a libertarian, and I think when most libertarians join the libertarian movement, we won't say the libertarian party, because I believe you can be a Republican, you can be a Democrat, you can be an independent, you can be a non-political person and be a libertarian. You don't have to be in the Libertarian Party. Sometimes it's preferable, which we'll talk about in a future episode. One of the things that helped shape me as much as anything was the Advocates founder, Marshall Fritz. And so before libertarianism.com existed in its current form, I worked in a job that Brett has previously had as the marketing director for the Advocates. And I was working on libertarianism.com, and in my version, which you can find at We Are Libertarians, and you can find it, I think it's We Are Libertarian/Libertarianism, and you just go to our front page and go to the path to libertarianism. And I post this, and it's actually in our feed. Like, if you're in the We Are Libertarians feed, go to your podcatcher and download this speech by Marshall Fritz, because I think it's so brilliant. I think this is the foundation of what the Advocates does, but also it's the foundation of libertarians. So when you first come in, you think it's all about issues. So we want to try and match issues, like there's some sort of game, you know, well, this tile of my beliefs slide into this or this or this. Now, that's why the quiz, it starts with issues, because I think that's where people first think. But libertarianism is not issues. If you're a Democrat or you're a Republican, when you say you're a conservative, that means to conserve an old order. But the old orders are different to different people in the Republican Party. What are you conserving?
Yeah, it's not a foundational tenet.
Yeah, there's no foundational principles within the Republican and the Democratic philosophies. There are no philosophies. They're coalition parties meant to be, they're empty vessels. Political parties are empty vessels. But if you agree with the majority of issues with this candidate, then you vote for that candidate. Libertarianism, you know, and it's the same with the Libertarian Party. I agree with Gary Johnson on 88% of stuff, right?
Yep.
You know, and future libertarian candidates, it may be 75%, it may be 99%, who knows? You know, but when it comes to issues, it's easy to get divided. It's easy to see where you disagree and don't agree with a person. Mm-hmm.
hugely violent fights over splitting hairs.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
libertarianism is the foundational principles that our parents taught us. As Advocates board member Ken Bassan says, it's don't hit your sister and don't take other people's stuff.
Yeah.
That's a paraphrase. And what Marshall talks about in this speech that I love so much, he starts out by talking and asking questions. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, Brett, if I came up and I walked up and I said, you have a nice hat, I want that hat, I'm going to take that hat, and I take it and walk away, is that moral for me to do so? No, it's not.
Even for little Brett Bittner.
Right. If I like the hat and I said, listen, I'm going to give you a hat, but I'm going to give you a quarter for it. So, you know, I'm taking your hat, but I'm giving you something in return. Is that moral to do so? No. Well, let's say that I like the hat, but I don't believe in stealing. So I'm going to go to Greg, the sheriff, and have Greg come and take it and have an agent come and take it. Does that make it moral for me to take your hat? No. Well, Greg and I, two against one, we voted, and we're the majority and you're the minority. I now own that hat because it's beneficial to us. He has a hat. Why shouldn't I have a hat? You've been outvoted. Does that make it more?
I just don't like Bittner and like to watch him suffer, so I'm going to vote with you.
So he walks you through it, and you start to realize, like, oh, government is against my own personal morality. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in stealing Brett Bittner's hat. I don't believe in punishing Brett Bittner for not giving me his property. I don't believe in hitting Brett Bittner to take his hat. That hat is Brett's property, and it is his to give to me. And so my own personal morality says taxation is theft. Well, I'm not a thief, so why should I say that an agent of the state should be allowed to do it? I don't believe in hitting other people. I don't believe in going over to other countries because I wouldn't want Canada coming here and doing that to us. If there were a Canadian government, a Canadian invasion, which it could happen, there's 98% of them live on the border. Why is that? That's a little shady. Came in here and instituted a mayor in Indianapolis and said, you know, you're not, you can still be Indianapolis, and Indianapolis can still be great. But we're going to make it Canadian great. And so we're going to institute a mayor, and we're going to institute a city council, and we're going to govern your country in a way that we think is best because we know best. Well, I don't think that's right. So I don't want to contribute to that. I wouldn't want that done to my country. I wouldn't want that done to me personally. So why is it okay for my government to do that in my name? So I look at my own personal morality as an individual and see my government doing things I would not do to another person, and I find it untenable and disgusting. And once you start looking through those first lenses, you start looking through it, you flip it around. So you're not engaged in the discussions of what – are you pro-abortion or pro-choice? You're pro-choice or pro-life? Are you this or that? Like, all of that really is meaningless. So you start to look at it and you go, okay.
They're divisions.
They're purposeful divisions. And most people agree on what is right and wrong. It's once we start using the government as a tool of force to make other people live in the way that we think is moral, they start to fight back. And so most people wouldn't argue over gay marriage because their neighbor that they love would just go get gay married at the church that
they don't have to
at the church that gays marries people, and they could go to their Baptist church that doesn't. So what's wrong with that society? But when you add government into the mix, people have to run to their sides and defend their position because the force of government could make them lose something. And so it just doesn't seem to be the kind of society that I like to live in. And I think that if we live a life as individuals who know what's best for us and vote that way, we're going to have a better society. And yes, it seems simplistic, but once you get that very basic kernel in your mind and you start to examine issues around that kernel and you start to explore that issue, you start seeing things like spontaneous order. You start seeing things that are really, you start seeing why individualism is important. You start to see why it's important to have a non-intervention foreign policy. So
I think one thing that does help you lead yourself into that in having the morality discussion that Marshall started in the speech that you're talking about is to consider who makes the best decisions for you. Who knows the most about your life and your family and your budget?
Yeah.
It isn't going to be a bureaucrat, you know, 30 miles away at the state capitol. It isn't going to be, you know, a congressman 500 miles away in the nation's capital. You're going to know what's best for you. You're going to know what's best for your family. You're going to know what's best for your budget. Mm-hmm. And when you outsource that decision making to somebody else, they're going to have a one size fits all solution.
Yeah.
And let's face it, we're a nation of 330, 340 million people. There's no one size fits all solution for the three of us in this room, let alone for 330, 340 million people.
Right. So my foundational principle is really summed best by David Bose from Cato, who wrote a book called Libertarianism. And he writes, almost every problem in society can be solved by more freedom and liberty, not less. More specifically, we, as in libertarians, value individualism, individual rights, spontaneous order, the rule of law. The rule of law meaning we set rules, we set laws, and everybody follows those laws as written. Now, of course, we've gotten into legal interpretation and that we've gotten away from the rule of law
down the rabbit hole on that one.
To the spirit of the law. Limited government,
demon pass.
Limited government, free markets, the virtue of production, which means people producing goods, means that more people can be prosperous, and natural harmony of interests. Now, what those last two mean, the virtue of production and natural harmony of interest means, is, you know, it's best exemplified in Leonard Reed's iPencil, mm-hmm. You know, where if you look at the miracle of the pencil, you look at the wood, the graphite, the rubber, the tin, the aluminum that goes around the band. You know, it would take one person an incredible amount of time to make one pencil because you'd have to go and get the cedar. You'd have to fly to where graphite is made, which is a very specific place in the world. You'd have to make the rubber. You'd have to get all the things that would go into that. Instead, people are happy to make money mining the graphite and logging the woods. And then it all comes together and it becomes this miraculous little item called the pencil that you then exchange money for their hard work. And if you think about all the things that are in your material life, think how long it would take you if you had to do all those things on your own. A book, if you have 50 books on your bookshelf, that's a miracle. Because you don't have to go and learn 50 different things. Somebody else did that and then had the skill to write a book. Somebody else had the skill to print the book. Somebody else had the skill to sell the book. And then you were able to buy the book because of your means of production. And so we live in a miraculous society because of capitalism, because we're able to read 50 different books and 50 different ideas, which then spawn us to go, this is a great idea. I'm going to build a business around it and start flourishing that idea.
Do you remember, I think it was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, when the guy grew his own wheat, like raised his own turkey.
Uh-huh.
And
subsistence farmer.
Right.
Well, he made a sandwich.
Right.
And it took him like 2 years.
Right.
And cost him like $1,500 or something crazy for him to go through everything that was necessary for him to make, I think it was a BLT.
Right.
So he had a baby pig. And he grew his own wheat, and he grew his own lettuce, he grew his own tomatoes, and he put it all together, and it took him a tremendous amount of time to do something that we can now go to the grocery store, get all the items, and make in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It took him years to be able to get to that point, because we're all working together as a cooperation. People oftentimes talk about capitalism and free markets as competition. But what it really is cooperation between producers and consumers.
Right.
Because we're finding that they can provide goods that we can't do as well on our own. And we're willing to trade what we do well for a medium of exchange. And we give that to them. So it makes a whole lot of sense to do what you're talking about with iPencil and to go to the grocery store to buy the bacon, to buy the lettuce, to buy the tomato, to buy the bread. If you put mayo on it, ew, but mayo. And instead of having to do all that on our own.
Right.
Which would be really, 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 really tough. So I like that it's cooperation. And you know, that kind of fits into the whole treat people as you want to be treated thing. Because you're able to cooperate. You're able to negotiate. I'm not forcing anybody to give me that bacon mm-hmm. or that lettuce or that tomato or the bread. I'm voluntarily exchanging it.
Yeah, and this is beautifully illustrated in Peter Schiff's book, How an Economy Grows and Why It yes. Crashes. It's half book, half comic book. I mean, it's really great, and it explains why it crashes, which is crony capitalism. People start buying off the government to use its force to plan outcomes and to make their business superior until we all work for major corporations, which nobody likes. Greg, what would you say that you... What are your tenets of libertarianism that you think are important?
The tenets of libertarianism. It's funny. I like all things. I start conceptually and then work down. So for me, libertarianism, I believe it's right. And what the core is about is it's the safest bet. So like the battle of all Western civilization is Plato versus Aristotle. It's what is the right system of government? Is it philosopher kings by an elite central planners? Or mm-hmm. is it a democracy of highly informed citizens in which gives you the best bet to hold on to individual freedom?
Right.
Plato says, I know best since individuals are in the cave and they don't know best. I have to tell them how to be free.
Sure.
They'll never live a virtuous life. For Aristotle, it's why Ayn Rand, objectivism, A is A. It is your best bet is to have a highly engaged citizenry and decentralized power.
Yeah.
And so I believe, even though I can't prove it, that humankind is meant for self-rule.
Sure.
I can't prove it. I can't point to it, and I really can't say that there's any individual or being or entity that's granted me that right. But I think that's the safest bet for the most number of people to have their best life.
Yeah.
And they're shot at their best life. And so what does that mean?
I think we can prove it, because when you look in terms of human history, when you study Western culture, when you look at the Dark Ages and it was the feudal system— and you had subservient farming, and then the Reformation comes along, and you start to see religion, it's not just a religious thing, religion was government at that time. And once Luther starts the Reformation off, that starts a revolution in government, which the Renaissance combined with the Reformation leads then to the Enlightenment, which leads to the ideas that we're talking about today, which leads to the American Revolution, which leads to the 20th century, when we go from building an airplane for the first time to landing on the moon 69 years later to, you know, planning Mars missions 40 years after that. You know, so when you see more individuals start to get freedom and start to pursue their own interests, then you start to see people pursue their passions and start to cooperate and build monumental things.
Oh, yeah, human progress advances significantly. Right. I just more so mean, like, I can't say that just because I'm alive, mm-hmm. I actually can't prove that I have the right to self-ownership.
Sure.
Right? And so I actually have to take a leap of faith and say, I think that's the best bet based on the evidence of what you just described.
Sure, because
that's a way better outcome for everyone alive right. than the alternative.
Right, because there are a lot of Republicans and Democrats who would say, you know, even Abdul, who I mentioned earlier, says there should be a professional political class because professional politicians know how to do government more efficiently.
Technocrats.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And like, you know, that's the battle. It's the battle of all civilization. And so I say, I have decided that I like just by the evidence you presented, self-ownership is the foundational tenet. If mm-hmm. I don't own myself, I don't own anything. I have to own my body first.
Or would we say he advocates for self-government? Brad?
That's what I heard.
Right.
I want an ownership society like George W. Bush. Some habits die hard. No, but self-ownership is the foundational tenet for me. And then as far as it goes, the right structure of government, I don't know. I mean, I believe that that the libertarianism is based upon a certain system of government. I hope it is, but it seems like any time government exists, even though government isn't evil, it presents in a vessel for force to be applied by the collective.
Right.
And then at the same time, I say, well, the alternative is the absence of it. And in that case, who's the arbiter and enforcement agency of justice? And so at a certain point, libertarianism has to be about justice in a just society and protect certain protections that are enumerated to each individual. And so you have self-ownership. You have what you are that is yours, your life, liberty, and property. And then you say, well, beyond that, where does that stop?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's the simple thing. It's the golden rule. It's my right to extend my fist stops at your face. It is anything and everything that has to do with a constitutional republic. And libertarianism, quite plain and simple, is clearly delineated rights that you can protect that you own. And your ability to hold on to those exists to the extent that you can protect them.
Right.
Sounds very philosophy of liberty. The video, Ken Skolin's video.
Sure.
That's essentially what Greg described.
Yeah, so which you can see in the Path to Libertarianism at wearelibertarians.com.
You're welcome.
So we're going to start wrapping up, but... you know, you wrote a great piece on Plato and Aristotle at wearelibertarians.com, kind of talking about that. That still exists. You know, the ancient Greeks, Plato versus Aristotle, still exists today, where I look at it and I go, no, man should rule himself. People can do it on their own, versus someone who is libertarian-leaning and Abdul, who is a great friend of mine, who says, no, there really should be a ruling political class. And it's
go to a Duck Dynasty conference and come back and tell me what you think about that.
Right. You know, so but that's the point, is there are Duck Dynasty people and there are Daily Coast people and there are libertarian people and there are anarchist people and there are, and so we don't all have the same values and we don't all have the same principles, we don't have the same morals, we don't have the same ethics. But in a society, we do, you know, I think it's not even a societal thing. I don't think it's a set of rules. It's just a human nature thing. As a human being, you adhere to a certain set of rules. You don't walk up and punch somebody in the face because that's robbing them of their life and liberty. And you, as a human being, have certain rights. You shouldn't be punched in the face. And if you are punched in the face, you have a right to protect yourself. And if you are punched in the face, you have a right for retribution. So let's say you are harmed. Someone walks and punches you in the face and you have a brain aneurysm and you die. Well, there should be restitution for that. There should be you should go to jail. You know, so I think a lot of the misconceptions about libertarianism are that it'll just be anarchy. Why don't you move to Somalia? That's so great. Which, the hilarious thing is Somalia is turning into a great free market state.
Right.
And businesses and capitalism are starting to flourish in Somalia because there was anarchy for a bit.
Because they finally took that advice and said, we're going to prove you wrong.
Right.
Well, and so many people confuse anarchy and chaos.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you take a look at something like The Purge,
mm-hmm.
the movie and subsequent sequels. People are confusing the two. Anarchy isn't necessarily chaos.
Mm-mm.
Because anarchy can be as simple as a farmer's market where people are voluntarily cooperating to mutually beneficial outcomes.
Birds flying in the air.
Yeah.
Okay, birds flying in the air is spontaneous order. So birds don't need the government to explain how to fly in certain packs.
Right.
They don't need the government to explain to them how to fly in the V formation.
Mm-hmm.
Birds spontaneously order themselves. If you took out all of the traffic signals, people eventually, would there be accidents initially? Yes.
Absolutely.
But eventually people out of self-interest would not get into car accidents. Mm-hmm. And if you got rid of all traffic signals, eventually the human animal eventually figures it out. They adapt and they
deers
start...
don't have government and yet they have tracks.
Right. You know, so it's, well, the reason that Boston's streets are so crazy is because it's laid out on cow patches. It's laid out on cow paths. I mean, so they eventually built the roads on free, anyways. So
I don't think we want to make that argument.
It's like the sidewalks at Berkeley.
Right.
They went a year to see where people would naturally walk
yeah.
before right. they built the sidewalks. rather than try to centrally plan it.
Right. Government, if you know, an effective use of government would be watching the existing order and then coming in and building the infrastructure on top of what already existed.
Right.
Right. But we look at it and go, when you have a free-flowing river, government is a dam that then builds a reservoir on accident. You see in crony capitalism the effects of a government that can be bought and paid for. And then the government uses that force to plan the winners and losers.
Mm-hmm. To send Evan Bayh to Indiana to run for Senate.
Yeah, go watch The Big Short. And Big Short is a great example of government and private business colluding to rob us, the taxpayers.
Yep.
That kind of quote-unquote capitalism does not exist in a free market society.
Well, because it's not capitalism.
Because it can't.
Right. It's cronyism, and it occurs at the intersection of big business and big government.
Right.
They both have similar interests in that they want to control things, and when they can work together to centrally plan an outcome, that's what they're going to try to do.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take into account our actions as individuals.
Because they don't think about us. We're numbers on a page.
Right. We're in the margin.
Right.
They have the 95% outcome, 95% outcome that they want.
That's one
and
of the
5% can just
That's one
go
of the
away.
Things that I loved about The Big Short movie is, you know, they show all these mortgages on mortgages on mortgages being rolled up and rolled up and rolled up, and they're just little dots. They're pieces of information. They're names on a sheet. They're not even looked at. It's just money, money, money. It's build this, build this. But then they go and visit the homeowners in Florida, and they open the door, and there's this guy, and he's like, has my landlord not been paying the rent? What am I going to do? And at the end, he's shown to be living out of a car because of the carelessness of the people that built these crappy mortgages. And anytime you remove the consequences from the direct, you know, if you're not going to face those consequences and you are able to play God, then, and other people are suffering the consequences, then that becomes harmful. I think so. Let's finish up and we'll talk about what we think are, let's finish on kind of what we think are the most important aspects of these principles that we talked about. I'm going to steal one that Greg has taught me that has really made me think a lot about, and that's incentive. And I look at it through private charity. For me, as a religious person, I believe that government is the worst way to operate charity. It is the least effective. And when you go back and listen to episode 144 of We Are Libertarians, and you hear the story of private charities being ineffective in helping someone in a domestic violence situation because they don't have enough resources, it makes me mad. Because they're hamstrung by mandates from the government on top of people not donating enough items and money because we're broke. I'm broke. You're broke. You're broke. Everybody's broke, you know, and everybody's living off of credit cards and they're making $40,000 a year or $50,000 a year and they can't afford stuff because the economy just, it's squeezing us tighter and tighter. And that's because of people up here don't have the incentives. Squeezing the little guy who suffer those consequences. And when you have a system of private charity, so what would we do with the poor? Humans are empathetic creatures. We are empathetic animals. And one of the best moments on this program that we've ever had was a comedian. And I always forget his name. I cannot think of the comedian that we saw.
Ricky?
No, it wasn't Ricky.
Damn it. Ross?
No, I love
you're
it.
I'm just going to guess our names until you get it.
I'm going to have to isolate it because it's just always escapes me.
Dan?
No. Stuart Huff. Stuart Huff.
That was my next guess.
and he was talking about this wolf pack of cars were driving along and somebody shot up over and went off the other side of the ramp. And everybody pulled over the cars and, you know, blacks, whites, Asians ran over to the side, helped this person, called 911. As they're all walking back, he thinks, nobody thought when they ran to help him, is that guy a Republican? Is that guy a Jew? Is that guy Muslim? Is that guy Christian? Is that guy Democrat? You know, we don't have that thought because you see a person in trouble, and in a society of the free market. Greg's laughing about something. He's throwing off my flow.
I'm so sorry, dude.
I said Jew.
No, it wasn't Jew. It was, well, everybody's already established it's either an Asian or a woman because they drove off the road.
Of course you did.
I'm so sorry.
And, you know, you have, when you take away the incentive to empathize with another hurting person, because, well, I gave my money to the government. They can sign up for WIC. They can sign up for welfare. You take away a person's ability to empathize and their power and the dignity of the person receiving the help. And when I donate to a charity, I am all in. I donate to some charities that I'm passionate about because they do good work in the world, and I follow my money and I want to go to their events and see what they're doing. I want to see what's happening with my money. I want to see that lives are changing, and I can. But when I go and look at DCS, lives are not being changed. Lives are being destroyed by quote-unquote government charity. And that's because we've removed the incentive to empathize with other human beings. And so in a system of private charity, we care more. And communities of faith care more. Individuals care more. And it's just a better system. And you didn't have as many dependent people. And the war on poverty in the 1960s and the FDR's New Deal created a whole new underclass of people that live off of other people. And I don't hate those people. I don't think that those are bad people, because I think that they're trapped in a system that is a bad system that is hard to get out of. And sometimes there's not incentive to do that. So that's why I believe in private charity. And I think that is probably the issue that I care the most about in terms of libertarianism. Like, the thing that I really want to impress upon people is that in a system of private charity, we care a whole lot more about other human beings. Brett?
Well, I actually want to build on what you talked about. We outsource responsibility.
Right.
You hit the nail on the head. We give. Taxes are taken from us. They're administered for the programs, and then we get back to the idea of one size fits all and those things being somewhat helpful. But I don't know that they are. I mean, I see the problems with everything that's happening with regard to how people are, quote-unquote, helped by government programs that are put in place as the safety net. And I know that before we had the FDR programs, the New Deal, the War on Poverty, we actually had a very robust system of groups like the Odd Fellows, or you had the
Lions Club,
the community coming together.
Yeah.
Right. That's what they were designed for. You know, the water buffaloes that you guys remember from the Flintstones.
Right.
It was a mutual aid society. They helped one another. But because it was easier to outsource that responsibility to government, then we don't have to care.
Sure.
Because we don't have to, we're not interested in seeing what happens. We're not, we end up getting pitted against one another. 4 years ago, I believe it was, that Mitt Romney talked about the 53% versus the 47%. And that was pitting people against one another.
Right.
It was the supposedly 53% of people work and produce, and the other 47% are just leeches,
sure.
Is a paraphrase of kind of what he was talking about. But when we outsource the responsibility of helping our fellow man and being involved in our community and actually doing the things that are right and moral, we're outsourcing morality to the government.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is the people in government change, and the morality changes with them.
Yeah.
And it's whatever the will of the majority at the time is, it's their morality. It's not Chris's morality. It's not Greg's morality. It's not my morality. It's somebody else's idea of what's moral and just.
Sure.
And when we can't determine for ourselves what's moral and just, we're not able to have the connections that you talked about.
Sure.
That you do in a private charity situation.
I think I used to have a very tough on crime approach, throw them all in prison, you need to make better choices.
Sure.
Then I got involved with Rupert's Kids, and I started to see that the way that the government has set up certain incentives, it keeps those kinds of guys in certain cycles. And I never would have been able to change my point of view had I not had a vehicle to get in, to connect to another person. Yep. That was not, let's be honest, Richard Samuels and Daron Caldwell are not people that I grew up around.
Right.
They're not people that I necessarily hang out with, but I would now that I know them. And I'm glad that I have the ability to know them because of my involvement in a private charity and your involvement in a private charity and a private organization here. You know, and I would say to piggyback on those private organizations like the Masons, like the Odd Fellows, when we had a society where those organizations were set up, we had a culture that was filled with racism, binded by shame and fear, and a great problem with a lack of emotional health. Now, I'm not saying our society is emotionally healthy at all, but we're a hell of a lot better than we used to be. And our generation, I think, the millennials, are striving to achieve more emotional health, striving to eradicate racism, striving to eradicate classism. And I don't think that that is necessarily the exclusive domain of social justice warriors on the left. I think it is ingrained in the American millennial because of our schooling, because of our parents. We are an open culture. We are a more moral culture in our class, in our age group than past groups. And we are ready for private charity. We're yearning for it. You see things like social entrepreneurs. We want the government out of the way to do this.
Right.
Because we want the ability to connect with other human beings that are not like us. And so when people want to throw back in your face, well, yeah, I'm sure the 1920s was a great time to be a part of one of these social clubs so you could reply, blah, blah, blah. Society's a hell of a lot different than it was 100 years ago. So shut up.
We're a lot more connected now than we were then.
Absolutely. So are you finished?
Well, no, the one thing that I did want to add to that, in talking about the social programs and how they don't help, did you know that if you give a gift for Christmas or graduation or whatever in the form of a check to somebody who is a food stamp recipient, their benefits can be reduced by that amount?
Holy
because
cow.
That amount of money appears in their checking account and it's beyond what they report as earnings, and they're actually penalized for it.
So the incentive then is to give them cash that they don't put in a bank account.
Absolutely. That's right. What you
so
do.
So you then drive a person underground.
Underground, right. Into the underground economy and black markets, and which are truly free markets. It's just they're driven underground because of the illegality or the shadiness. Now, is it
charity breaks the law?
Charity breaking the law, essentially. So let's say, for example, my niece graduates from kindergarten and I want to give her $50, but her parents get food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
That money is then taken out of their benefits the next month.
Mm-hmm.
And so what did I learn? I learned that I don't write them a check.
Yeah.
I'll either buy stuff for her or I'll give cash.
Yeah.
Or I'll come around with an extra legal way to make it happen.
Yeah.
Because you're disincentivizing people helping.
And the vast majority of food stamps go unclaimed. Right. And, that's the sick part.
And on the same,
it's a giveaway to corporate, you know, to Dow ConAgra.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so on the flip side, you know, I was having an argument with a conservative. It wasn't an argument. It was just a discussion saying, yeah, I know, but illegals, man, some of these people are monsters. You know, I have this friend, and it was an anecdotal thing where a friend was raped and everybody knew who was. Nobody got away with it. And I said, yeah, why do you think that is? They're all illegal. There's no incentive for everybody to go and do the thing that is moral,
testify.
Which is turn this person in, which is to stand up and say this person violated what we call the non-aggression principle, which the NAP, which
I love NAPs.
A person aggressed against someone sexually, that person then should be held accountable. But they can't because the system has set up a group of people, because I think racism is infinitely stupid. I think it is so dumb for me to look at a black person, or to me to look at not even racism, bigotry in general, to look at a Catholic person or a Jewish person and say, you're less than me because you believe a certain way or look a certain way. That is so dumb. Like, it's just so moronic. Like, knowing what, like, it just to look at a person who has black skin, it's just dumb. And I look at borders the same way. For me to look at a Vietnamese person or a Mexican person or a British person and say, you're less than me because you don't live in these imaginary boundaries, I think is stupid. And so that thinking of nationalism has made it so that people can be predators in certain communities in our society. And I don't find that to be moral. I think that person should go to jail. Captain Helicopter.
What are we discussing? We got on private charity.
I know. Now, we're talking about what we think are the most important, what you personally find to be the most important aspects of the libertarian philosophy. For us, it's private charity. It's incentives. For you, it may be economics. It may be...
It's fear. If you want a better case to be made of why libertarianism is so important and why it is your best bet at getting a chance to be free and live a happy life, if you want to see... I don't believe every progressive or every Democrat wants to use government, you know, in order to create awful, you know, awful outcomes. They're trying to help people. They have the best of intentions, but it's, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. So the real fear is this election. It's the progressive built this big monster and handed it over to Donald Trump, because in a democracy, you hand over the keys after you leave office. And libertarianism doesn't, no matter who wins, they never have that vehicle to have that control over you. And to me, that's the real, the single most important element of libertarianism, is that it is always your best bet. It is always the right way to go about it, because you never have to worry about the, you know, an angry mob finally tipping the election in one way and handing over a government that can violate posse comitatus based on a legal interpretation.
Right.
You know, that is the foundational and most important sales point of libertarianism, is that every worry you'd ever have about bad intentions or a certain situation arising isn't a worry anymore.
Ironically, the argument that it would be anarchy and chaos, it's the exact opposite. It really is stability, because you are the one planning the outcomes. It is not 535 people in Washington planning your outcomes for you and how your child will be educated and how, you know, they will be dressed when they go get educated. I mean, it is stability.
It is. It's stability, and it's the absence of fear, which, you know, fear usually drives people more than the potential for gain. And so that being the case, you know, as a libertarian, how can you go out and say, I support Bernie and want Bernie to go out and create, you know, a bigger government, but with the right-minded people to roust out corruption and do the right thing and help people? And then you never know, 8 months later, you hand over this monstrosity to a Donald Trump or to someone even worse, or to a Rick Santorum or Sarah Palin, or no matter what, you know, who it is. That's the dilemma of every statist and progressive and liberal, is, oh my God, we may not be in power forever.
Sure.
Well, and, you know, one of the questions that I like to ask people is, think of the person that you trust the least. And would you give them the power that you're giving your guy, the good king that you are voting for? How would you feel if the shoe was on the other foot and the bad guy that you can't stand has that same power? And no one considers that.
Never.
Greg, I'd like to apologize to you, because exactly what he described is what has happened on this podcast. We've given the keys to We Are Libertarians over to the person I would least like to see run this podcast.
Now do you see why I support free helicopter rides?
forcibly remove Brett from my apartment, yes. So to speak.
Time to call Hoppa.
All right. So let's, if you are finished, we'll wrap up. Give a pitch if people want to find out a little bit more about libertarianism from your point of view, I guess.
Well, what I would like to share with people is the opportunity to go to libertarianism.com. We're building the next step, or we've built the next step to follow up the world's smallest political quiz.
Which is great.
We're talking about it as Find Your Freedom. That's what we're calling this particular aspect of things, where you go through the quiz, and based on your outcome, you get a specified path that hopefully opens your eyes to more libertarian things. And I'd love for everybody who's listening to go through the entire program at libertarianism.com. Hopefully you get Chloe in the videos and not me.
Oh, I did it and I got statist and I had to see you. So you might want to be a libertarian.
Well, it's a 50-50 shot that you'll get Chloe or you'll get me. And once you're locked into one path, you're only getting that one person.
I heard Chloe is smoking hot, but she never shows up to anything, so I wouldn't know.
So at libertarianism.com, go through, take the quiz. There's two videos, one that is there to build a rapport with you. That's one of the things that we talk about, is a very important aspect of communication, where we build a connection. And then the second one, we're asking some questions that challenge what your outcome typically believes, you know, whether it's an authoritarian, whether it's liberal, whether it's conservative, whether it's centrist, even if it's libertarian, we're hoping to persuade you to be more libertarian based on whatever outcome you had, and that the messaging that we have is something that does aid you on the path to it being a more libertarian individual. We are looking to have people who think that they can do a better job. Because trust me, this is my first attempt at it.
Sure.
This is Chloe's first attempt at it. We're putting things out there because nobody is doing this. No one is actively using something as easy as this is to try to convert people to be more libertarian.
Except at wearelibertarians.com to go to the path to libertarianism. I find it to be superior, but apparently the overlords at the Advocates for Self-Government did not. So,
Just go through, share with your friends and family, and if you think that you can do something like Chris has done that you think would help people on the path to libertarianism. Hey, we can build
it right
that
now.
We can
submit what you
we can
right
build
now.
It in. We can build it in. Hopefully, it will work with what we've done. Chris, feel free to share your path to libertarianism. Wow, this does look familiar.
Didn't we delete this?
The Advocates for Self-Government?
info@theadvocates.org is where you should send your email with a link to what you're working on, or if you want to be a partner.
Subject, never bitten. All right.
But, you know, it's something that we want to have multiple partners that are interested in trying out how they think that you can persuade people to be more libertarian, and we'd like to have more players in the game. Right now, we put it out there so that you guys could see what we're working on, and you can see what you could improve, what you could do different. Maybe you hate the idea of videos, and you want it to be walls of text. Maybe that's your vision.
I love walls.
I know. So does Greg, but especially walls
higher.
Of text.
10 feet higher.
You know, maybe that's the angle that you want to take. Maybe it's that you want to subject people to 2-hour podcasts about libertarianism. Maybe it's that you... Well,
it's working so far.
You know, so there are many different ways that we can do this, and we're looking for people that might be interested in doing it. But most importantly, I'd like for you guys to visit libertarianism.com and go through the world's smallest political quiz and find your freedom in the next step.
I signed up.
You did. He signed up for the Liberator.
And I got Chloe and I deleted. Every message I get that says an Agnos in it, delete.
Subject, more boobs.
Oh, God.
You want liberty, man. All right. Thank you for joining us on this episode of We Are Libertarians. If you found it informative, if you found it helpful, then please share it. If you found it at all, please share it. We appreciate it, and you can find out more at WeAreLibertarians.com. We thank you so much for joining us on this episode, and as always, we promise
to do better next time. Never bitter.
Join us every month for drama and suspense. And memes. A political podcast unlike any other. Join us for We Are Libertarians Live every month at Morty's Comedy Joint in Indianapolis. Learn more at WeAreLibertarians.com/live.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.